Up, it is February 27th, 2008. I'm still stuck in the Oneida 19th century, I think. Yeah. We have here with us Ed Sherry and Ron Shore, who both, one currently lives and one previously lived here communally in the Lawrence area. I've asked them simply to come in and tell what some of their communal experiences are and just let it be a fairly free conversation about that. So either one of you can start as you prefer. Just tell a few basics about it.
Yeah, I might start. Okay. As a background, I was raised in Joplin, Missouri, a Catholic background, and went to parochial schools. And Catholics in Joplin are a minority, so it's kind of a pretty tight group. So all your recreational stuff is with Catholics, and your dances are Catholics, and your mathematics is Catholics, and your geography, everything is Catholic. So it's a kind of a community inside a town, sort of thing. So also, I had my Aunt Catherine had 11 kids, and my Aunt Rosalie, she had 7 or 8. I can't remember. And then my Aunt Rita, she had 4, and on and on. So that I spent my childhood basically hanging out with my cousins. So that's kind of a sort of a precursor to community kind of thinking, I guess. There was the whole food thing. I graduated from high school, Catholic high school. And somehow or another, I was asked by the bishop to go to the seminary. I was planning on becoming an aeronautical engineer, but anyway, he said, you know, I'd like you to give it a try. And to this day, I don't know how that happened. And so I ended up in a monastery in northern Missouri, Immaculate Conception Abbey, Benedictines. Excuse me. And so we ate together, we prayed together, we had, you know, lived in, you know, it wasn't a lot different than being in college, really, I guess. I mean, there were dorms. But, I mean, we had a big room, like, first year, all the boys were in one big room, you know, just beds, you know. And, you know, we had showers and, you know, sports, lots of sports. Academically, it was pretty good. And then we were taught and influenced by the monks, you know. And then, of course, we all ate together at the same time, the same food. And so that was kind of my first. I was trying to isolate the idea of collective. I mean, that one was definitely a commune. So. Then I got out of, I graduated with a degree in philosophy, and then went and taught in a parochial school, and then got married, and then went to graduate school and taught again. And then I got caught up in the draft in 67. And then I think there was always this gravity, you know, to go to where there's food, you know, where there was, you know, things were shared, like in the community and in the block and poker and girlfriends and blah, blah. And so I moved to Lawrence, and one of the main reasons was there was a really neat sense of community here. And that was 1971, and it was like right after the riots, and there were some real communities going on, and one was the CIA house, which Ron can tell you about, which I used to hang out there. There was food and lots of girls. And And there was a camaraderie and a certain sense of being against the status quo. And then I ended up at Abaji, which is where I live now. And I've lived there on and off for 25 years. And it's a...
Get you some water.
Water would be good. Anyway, Abaji is kind of a loose situation. It kind of started off with five sisters. And they were all beautiful ladies. I don't know, it's one of the reasons I got there. But also I had a lot of building skills, and they had gotten the land and they were building their houses, and so I became handy, as it were. And so let's see. And the way that situation's set up is there's currently three different families living on the same land. And really that's about all that's really communal about it. We have a laundry that we share, and we share expenses, which is a big thing. I mean, and we have a beautiful lake, and people come there, and there's a sense of community. I think my motivation for being involved in it is kind of having to do with my background, is that there is a family and sort of a community background or need or something. And so I would gravitate to those kind of things, and it involved other people and food and basically working out the necessities of life, you know, a place to live and all that. So maybe I can come up with more information with questions later, but or however you're going to do
okay.
It.
Okay.
Let me get something to drink here. If you want to pick up on something.
My name's Ron. And I'm also of a generation. I came to Lawrence in 1965 to go to graduate school. And I originally came from New York, went to City College of New York, which was a commuting college. They didn't have dormitories. I took the subway to school every day. So I really didn't have a tremendous experience with the social life. When I was in undergraduate school, I made friends in Lawrence, other graduate students. There were some that were living in McCullum Hall, which was had a lot of graduate students in there, and I used to hang around with them. And I really liked the atmosphere, but I was kind of, you know, I was living in the student ghetto over on Tennessee Street. Which was an experience also. It was a time when many things were going on, like revolutions. There were curfews in Lawrence at this time. That's in the 70s. But the atmosphere that built up to this, you know, went on a long, long time. Lawrence has always been kind of a counterculture, multiple culture community. And I became exposed to a lot of these people, hippies, some of them, intellectuals. And around 1969, I saw this ad for the CIA house. And it sounded interesting and cheap. I'm just going to tell you a little bit about the CIA house, if you didn't know. Primarily the child of Keith Miller, who's still a professor at KU. He and some of his buddies found that there was a fund available. During World War II and perhaps even before that, there were several attempts at cooperative living in Lawrence. One of them was called the Rochdale Co-op, named after a co-op in England. And all these gradually failed, probably maybe in the 50s or so, 50s and late 40s. And
I went to close to 1970.
Really?
Yeah.
Anyway, the money, when these buildings were sold, the money went into a fund. And Keith knew about this, and they applied for that money, and they bought a house at 1406 Tennessee. Actually, it was two houses. Now, I'm going to tell you, be honest, I don't remember all this, you know, a whole lot of this stuff. This is 40 years ago. But there was a guy, Tim, who was kind enough to remind me of his name. His name was Larry Crum, and he was a Crum. He decided to buy, I think he was the person, he bought two houses and kind of built them together and wanted to turn it into a nursing home, which he did, and it wasn't very good. I think he either went out of business or got put out of business, and they actually left the nursing home with some people still living in there. And the CIA, I think the way they came up with the CIA is first they came up with CIA and then they found the name Campus Improvement Association that fit with the letters, which kind of gives you an idea of where their mind was, you know, what was playing on this. Anyway, they got a hold of this funds and they bought the house. And it was really ideally suited for cooperative living because it had these rooms. They wanted to run it as an experiment. And it was pretty well suited for that because you could have the controls on one wing of the building. I saw a look on your face when you probably lived there. Or, okay. Anyway, you know, there's one wing of the building and they had a control group over there, and the other wing of the building, they wanted to have controls, organization, people having to work to keep the place clean, stuff like that, while the other place could be squalor, and see how the various residents dealt with this. So I was a guinea pig. The people who lived in there, they wanted to have a town gown sort of a situation. You didn't have to be a student to be in there. But there was data taken. I became pretty good friends with the student manager of the CIA house. His name was Steve Davis. And I ended up being the treasurer. I was probably a few years older than most of the people who lived there. So I kind of got drawn into this responsibility, although I wasn't really drawn into the game that they were into, the ownership. But it was pretty interesting. We had experiences with, there were some people who moved in there and wouldn't do a darn thing. And we would have meetings, and I would say so-and-so is not paying rent. What do we do? And there was a complete variety of ideas. Some people were revolutionaries. The result of this particular meeting was that, well, you know, we have to make room for all sorts in this thing, so, okay, so they won't pay rent. And the CIA went on for a few years like this, and it, for all I know, they may have been drawing data. This might have been, you know, one series of experiments, but later on it became much tighter and more organized and sort of, you know, either you're in or you're out. It was a really great bunch of people. I was living there when the Union burned down, or part of it, and when the killings went on in Lawrence. I don't know if you folks are familiar with all this. You know, there was curfew. Several of the residents were revolutionaries. And one day I went out of my room and looked in another room, and there were some people, some of the residents, with the window cracked open, holding guns trained on the street. And they were stoned out of their minds. And they were paranoid. So there were many, many different kinds of experiences that went on there. We shared meals. We went through that sort of a thing where we would work out menus and people would be assigned to cook for a week or whatever. Because it had been a nursing home, they had a central kitchen where we could cook for 20 or 30 people. It was a really good experience. Kind of, you know, leave it at that, and if anybody has any questions.
Wasn't the vortex there too?
I don't, there was a series of revolutionary papers, newspapers, that were published in the 60s in Lawrence. There was a thing called Reconstruction, and I think that morphed into the vortex. And a number of the people who published that were living at the CIA house. It was a place where, you know, which drew on this. I might mention one thing, that being a few years older and kind of crossing the two parts of societies, there were a lot of people that I would describe as hippies, you know, just free livers. And on a number of occasions, when parents would visit Lawrence, they would invite me to be in the room with the parents to kind of be as a translator or smooth. The parents would behave a little bit better because there was someone else in the room. And that was kind of an experience also. Sometimes the parents didn't behave better, and sometimes the kids didn't either. But anyway, that kind of gives a framework of the way it was, at least in my mind. So I'm going to turn it over to Professor Miller.
Well, I have plenty of questions I can ask, but if some of you have specific things you'd like to follow up on, then jump in.
Ed. No, it's kind of sewed up. it started out kind of with the five sisters, and then three of them ended up there, and then with their spouses, and then they built houses, and then they got divorced, and they had babies, and so.
Not necessarily.
Yeah,
in
no particular order.
In no particular order. And so there's basically three families that live there. Now, some people are friends of theirs, and it's like, so they, and there's parties like May Day, there's a maypole party that attracts a lot of people come out for that. Like, do the maypole, it's sort of, you know, the bonfire and potluck, and there'll be weddings out there of family members and who now are have their own kids. And so I've been out there since 25 years, I guess. So in the meantime, so there's no like housing for anybody. It's just there's. Except for the three families,
it's kind of like with families and their children and stuff. It always seemed to me like a
friends.
Really big extended family.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if I may follow up impolitely, there's a chance you may not all live forever. So, are new members going to come in at some point?
I tell you what, we have been grueling over that one forever, and there's currently, we're talking to Brown, the lawyer Brown, some sort of a limited liability corporation kind of thing. It's just, because the ownership is really weird, you know, it's like, it is weird. I don't even want to go into it. It's so weird. So some of the people who were there originally have absolutely no ownership at all. And then some people who aren't even there have ownership. And it's like, it's crazy. Yeah, it's just crazy. So anyway, they're trying to, some people are interested in bequeathing it to their children or their grandchildren or whatever, you know, and they don't have any legal rights. Some do and some don't, but there's no rules at this point, and we keep trying to do it, and it just seems to always fizzle out somewhere or another. I don't know. Yeah, that's a good question. There's no answer for it yet, but I'm not worried about it. When I'm dead, I'm not going to be worried about it.
So you don't own your house, really?
Well, I think there is a... I think if you don't own the land, you don't own the house, right? I mean, right. I think you have to have... You got to be able to sell it in order to own it. So that's true.
Right.
But they're just... We just live there.
Even though you built it.
Right. So
that goes back to the 1960s also, doesn't it? Obagene.
I think it's more right around 72, or 3 or something, because it was after 70. Because I came in 71, and I moved in there originally.
Kind of an interesting thing. I just happened, and this is a total coincidence. I lived right. It's kind of a zigzaggy road that they live on. It's called Stair Step Road, and I live right around the zag, or maybe it's the zig. You know, we're neighbors, and I guess I started visiting people and visiting OBG in the early 70s also. I didn't really have a sense of the time, and I don't know how many other people have this feeling, but it's got a certain aura, the whole place. It's almost like sacred ground. At least that's the way it seems to me, and I don't know if this kind of a thing develops or whatever, but you've been out there. Have you ever had that kind of a feeling that it's...
Yeah.
Something special.
Absolutely.
And not just the people. Yeah.
The place itself. Yeah. But the people help make that.
Yeah, yeah. It's a product of the people.
I don't know.
Or not.
How long were you at the
CIA? I lived there for over a year. It seemed to be probably maybe even 2 years. God, it's really hard to say. It was a really developmental period for me, and so much went through, including drugs, I had many, many, many experiences, more than fits into the year or two that I lived there.
What would that mean?
I'm sorry?
Describe the means.
Athenian democracy. You know, there would be someone brings up something, or there would be an agenda. Sometimes we would have an agenda, sometimes we wouldn't. Sometimes, it's on some things we would try to have scheduled meetings at, you know, certain dates and things like that. That didn't work, of course. So usually it was a meeting when there was some kind of a problem, and then anybody who had anything to talk about would have their say, but most interesting ones were the ones that were just in response to some sort of a new crisis or this or that. People behave very independently. I don't know if I should say this from the professor, but we had some pretty wild parties, and we had discretionary funds, which supported these parties. And they, well, I mean, like I was,
the treasurer.
I was the treasurer, and my friends were the managers, and we had some pretty good parties, and it did definitely promote camaraderie. The details of the meetings, I really.
The Attorney General, it was so notorious. Vernon Miller, yeah.
Yeah, Vernon Miller. I wasn't there then. I was there when the curfew was going through, and it was sort of an interesting little story. It was this governor's son, something, or Kansas senator's son, who was a member of a fraternity across the street. And he came over, he was friends with people in the house, and he had a police band radio. And we were listening to this radio, and like people in the National Guard were saying, they're sitting on their porch, and we're across the street hiding behind the bushes, and we're gonna get the SOBs and blah, blah, blah. And we were listening to all this, and actually, they did come over and they did threaten us. It was during that curfew period. Vern Miller was kind of a different phase in the politics of Kansas and Lawrence.
So would you say it was mainly economic the reason you settled there? As opposed to,
Both.
You were attracted to the novelty of the situation.
And I'd become more interested in people and interacting with people and stuff like that, which I didn't do a whole lot of in New York.
Right. Mm.
So you know, it was an experience. I started to like people more. And I've got friends from back then. A lot of people hang on in Lawrence. We were talking about a few people just a week or two ago, and Nancy Broom. The doors were either open or closed. They just had rooms, halls and rooms, and people would. Would decorate their rooms as they want. Oh, let's see. I remember there was one room. There were a couple of kids. I mean, probably younger than anybody in this room. And they put in ultraviolet fluorescent lights and stars on the ceiling and everything like that. They screwed around a lot. And they like to have booming music and all kinds of stuff like that. You could do anything you wanted. I was into painting things. I painted things, murals on my walls in my room. I often wondered if they were still there. in one of the rooms, one of the communal rooms, I think it was painted with like deck of cards, face cards, and things like that. Fabulous. Some pretty fabulous murals and things like that there. I kept my door open unless I wanted to close it. Some people would wander in. Sometimes I'd find some people sleeping on my bed. I think I did have a lock on it. Yeah, the doors did have locks, so you could have that privacy.
In the case of Abuji, Ed, what kind of, you talk about the three families that live there and the five sister owners and whatever the deal is. What does the next generation think of it all? The children of the original founders, I guess they're grandchildren now, right? So.
Well, there are grandchildren.
Are they pretty attached to the place?
Well, you know, they, you know, it's like home, but it's like coming back to home as opposed to their living there, you know. I mean, it's like, I don't know, that's a good question. Next, you know, May Day, you should go talk to them and talk to them about it. Get, so.
Do any of them live there now?
No. Well, Copper's a, is the last that generation. She's, you know, junior in high school. Most everybody, I mean, generally, you know, they go to, generally after high school, the kids leave. You know, go to KU or wherever, and they get apartments with friends, and usually and establish their own little communities in town, generally. Share living and stuff, but they always come out for, you know, things. Well, it's taxes and utilities, and the place is paid for, which is, it makes it living there really reasonable. I mean, I don't know how people pay rent in this town. It's like unbelievable. So, you know, like gravel for the driveway and or, you know, washing machine breaks down, you know, it all comes out of the, we pay kind of a monthly per person, really. Pardon me? Say again. Oh, only on occasions, you know, potluck is kind of the big deal, but on a regular basis, everyone eats separately. There's no simple food thing.
How many non-relatives live at this place?
Non-relatives.
Yeah, how many people that aren't related to each other? I know you're one of them. Are there any others?
Well, I mean, like I have a partner there. That, I mean, we're related, kind of. I mean, in a common law.
This just sounds like kind of like an extended family. Is there a time when anyone could, when you were getting people, and also like, where is this, how large is it, what does it look like, what do you do on a daily basis?
It's like 15 acres, it's mainly wooded, and it's got a really nice pond, or swimming pond, and I mean, it's not real big, but it's, on a daily basis, people go to work.
Outside?
Generally, Laura's a sculptor and she has her studio there. And Mel has a dojo and teaches Aikido on the place. So, and then everybody else is at KU except me, and I do construction.
And so you're like a founding member?
Kind of, yeah. Well, I was an original member. And at the time, I really wasn't connected with anybody. And I raised a daughter there for a while. And I came and went. And then I ended up married to an ex of one of the original people.
So you don't sound too contentious about having property rights there. You're not too worried about.
I'm not.
You know, you invested time and money.
I'm not. I don't have a sense of that, and I'm not. I don't know where that, why that is.
And Ron, nothing's changed since then. Except there may be less arms.
Oh yeah, it was armed. Lots of
information. Well, I hope the people still have a good experience this day.
He's there now.
Every once in a while, I feel like stopping at the end of that.
So they're eating together there now? Wow, no kidding. That's cool. That was really neat.
Is it fully occupied?
Not fully.
What about diverse people? Very diverse in terms of students and non-students,
yeah.
Ages and everything.
And who are the powers that be in this matter? I mean, there's a governing board. Do they make rules, or do you
abolish the manager?
Abolish the manager.
When I was there. Like I say, they tried different things, but the bottom line is you've got to bring in enough money to pay the mortgage payments and stuff like that. That was a very, very important thing. Because if people didn't do that, it was only partially financed by this fund. They didn't go out and say, here it is.
It's only now.
Well, you know, when you consider that the mortgage might be 30 years, the place was 1969, so it's 29 years. I don't know how long the mortgage was for. How many people live in Obegi at this point? I was kind of wondering that.
Another 12. Chuck and Judy and Laura and I and Copper.
So we have six adults and one child there now.
Yeah.
But then you've also got people living nearby who are kind of sympathetic, so to speak, right?
Well, there's kind of like Oak Lake and next door.
Yeah, exactly.
It's real simple. Yeah. Actually, there's 20 acres next door to us that has a similar situation, but they've figured it out. They kind of snuck it in before the rules changed, but they have like a couple of acres surrounding their house that each can buy and sell, and there's actually three houses there. Karen Seibel, Chuck's sister.
Oh, I know who she is, yeah.
Right. So there's like Laura's brother is one of the main people, and then Chuck's sister is one of the, so, but it's like there's a, you know, so it runs differently. And then there's the son of Margaret's son. So there's like three families over there next door that we interact with pretty regularly. So it's a big unit.
Now, there was a question about food out there. I wanted to ask you, Ron, about food. You ate together at CIA to some degree. How did you decide what to eat and who cooked and where did you get the food?
I know that different people first expressed willingness to cook, and we had so we had a kind of a nucleus of cooks, and that would be arranged. Other people would have other jobs that they felt more appropriate. I'm sure you had 25 people in there, and everybody was required to do cooking. There'd be a lot of poison. So you know, it was people who were better at cooking and more interested in that would do the cooking, and they wouldn't have to do the cleaning of the bathrooms and stuff like that. How it was organized, I really don't remember. It kind of, sometimes it was better organized, sometimes it wasn't. It seemed like there was a pot that always boiled, and yeah, it was always on the stove.
I wonder whether buying clubs and
that's what
food
I
cooperatives it didn't arise from that.
I don't think it really arose from it, but it was a convenient. There was the community mercantile is actually a child of a variety of buying clubs in Lawrence. There was one that largely did milk, things like that, and dairies. It was, I think, over on Ohio Street. There was one that I was participating in that would go into the farmer's market, or the city market in Kansas City once a week, and bring back stuff. And that was over on 600 block of Massachusetts. And a lot of these things would kind of be located out just for a day a week or a few hours at a place that was convenient, it was available. So there was some stuff, some buying clubs and stuff like that, that used the place of the mercantile, CIA house. But I don't really, I can't say that or remember that it was any more closely tied in than that.
So you probably went to the grocery store like anyone else and generally got at different places.
I suppose. It's not really in my mind right now.
Okay.
Where do you guys get your food? Just someone's assigned and goes, has a shopping list. See, we're here to learn also. And actually, I think Ed was the carrot that Tim held out is I can hear more of Ed's story. You can hear some of my story. So this is very educational for both of us.
Did you have people you just couldn't give credit on?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what'd you do? Some of them must have been.
Well, I mean, there was one person. Who's a very good friend of Keith's, who I really wanted to get rid of. He was brilliant. He lived in a suite of rooms downstairs with his two wives, and he refused to pay rent, and he refused to participate. And I, as the treasurer, had to go talk to him about paying rent, and he simply says, "You can't make me. You can't get me." and that was one of the meetings that I called about that. And frankly, it was towards the end of my period there, because it was sort of like I was putting in a lot of time, you know, as the treasurer and stuff like that. And people feel that there's enough, in, you know. And I said that my position is we have to pay the rent. You know, that's the only thing that, as far as I was concerned, had to be done, and that I had been told. And they said, "Well, yeah, we have to make room for diversity." And at that point, I kind of lost interest in putting in all that effort. I was going to be part of that diversity. there were things like that. And there were people who were marginally obnoxious enough that you really wish they'd go out, but There was one very sweet person there. I don't know if you can, like I say, there are two houses that are built together. And when you go in the central door in the middle, there are stairs going into one room and upstairs. And this girl lived on the north wing on the second floor, right at the top of the stairs. And it was an older house. The floors kind of settled a little bit. They weren't perfectly level. I don't know if I should be.
Please.
Anyway, they weren't perfectly level. And she was really nice. Her name was Shep. And she had a rabbit. And she had a cage inside her room. And the rabbit would poop. And sometimes you would bounce out, the little pellets would bounce out of the tray, and because the floor wasn't level, it would roll under her door and go clink, 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 down clink, clink down the stairs. And we could expect that at any time. And eventually we had to tell her that either she got rid of the rabbit or she, because there were health code things.
Yeah. That's one thing.
You can't have pets? Well, there were pets.
There were pets.
Oh, yeah.
And as a matter of fact, like I said, Ed and I were talking a little bit about memories, and the thing that's stirred this is for Tim's memories, is we were at a kind of a we just couldn't remember the name of her dog. She had it. She had a really, really big dog that is probably half dog and half wolf, and very, very protective of her. And that was one of the occupants of the house. It was called Rudy. His name was Rudy. Everybody remembers Rudy.
I want to ask you both. Go ahead.
I just want to ask. I know a lot of guys that work out going to do sexualities because they've done all of their life and you don't have to stuff. Mm-hmm. Do you feel the same thing about
that came. I mean that was a result of it, but that certainly wasn't the decision leading to it. I tried lots of different things. And it just happened that there were a number of really, really good people who were in this situation and people who I cared, to continue my relationship with. But it wasn't something, a conscious decision. These are connections. Matter of fact, the connections that I made there probably wouldn't help me. in the financial world or whatever. It's a good question.
Yeah.
Did you have a racial diversity there at that time?
Probably as racial as Lawrence is. There were a few minorities. I don't remember any Asians or a couple of blacks.
Wasn't that an Afro house?
Tiger Dadville?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're not, you're asking, I don't remember that stuff. There was a guy named Nick Rice.
Nick Rice was from across the street here.
Yeah. And I think that was the main focus of what was going on. There were people who abused me. All the worst of the police and stuff like that came out during these things. but I wasn't. You have to remember that, that we did have the Journal World, and they printed all the news that they saw fit to print, and they denied that there were vigilantes and stuff like that, and there were. And I'm not sure if there was. We heard that. Remember, was it Gamble's department store or something like that? And, that some people would gather on the roof. Just like I was talking about going out one day from my room and seeing people, you know, like freaks with guns. Well, they were the other type also, and they were doing things. I don't think the police were really controlling them. I don't know of any meetings or anything like that that went on that they were.
Any products sold to the outside world? Laura's art, right?
Oh, Laura is an artist and a sculptor, and she does, she's carving right now a lion out of limestone. It's like 4 feet tall and 9 feet long, and it's for a high school in Lansing. I mean, so she sells art. And then Mel has students come onto the place. And he has a dojo where he does
martial arts stuff.
Are you wondering if there was anything collaborative going on?
Oh.
Does she sell artworks under the name of poetry?
Oh, no. No, three of the six people work at KU here as in the language teaching foreign students English. Three of them. No, there's no product that's got. So there was originally the five sisters, and their grandmother was called Abaji by one of the kids when they were a baby, and it was like weird pronunciation. that's all I know.
I just want to ask you both quickly, in your case, what do your neighbors, not the sympathetic ones, but the larger neighborhood, what do they think of you, and what did the neighbors think of CIA House in 69, 70?
I don't think we ever had any problems with neighbors. We kind of sneered at all the fraternity houses that were kind of across the street, but we didn't really have any interaction with them. There was sort of an apartment house that was just across the street. I think that's still there, isn't it? And we never had any trouble with them either. We don't have big windows that, you know, that you can stick your butts out of or anything like that to offend anyone. We just did our thing, and it was behind the doors. Yeah. And I don't know of anybody doing any complaining or anything like that. There were some wild people who we didn't do wild things, at least in public.
Was the bar, the bowl still probably a bar?
We used to go, it was a little bar, and we used to go there a lot.
What was in the
I was trying to think of the name of that was.
Which one? It was the beer stew for a while.
Yeah.
It was something else before that. The library for a while.
I just can't remember what it was called.
What about Abuji?
Well, I was going to ask Ron to answer that first.
Okay.
If you don't mind.
Well, my...
Because, see, he's a neighbor. He...
Well, one thing is the people who live at Abuji are, even if they're not artists, they're kind of artistic people. They're some inspiration or something like that. It just happens in our neighborhood. There are a number of people who are in the arts, and the people who are in the arts are good friends with the people at Abuji and kindred spirits. But Abuji has always been a good relationship with their neighbors. You know, we never had any problem. We've always been invited to the parties. There are a lot of people who, you know, just don't go and socialize there. That we've never heard anybody say anything bad. We don't know what goes on over there. I mean, it's just a wooded area, and everything's set back, and their lives are their lives. And I mean, okay, it's kind of communal sort of a thing. There are different families that, well, it's none of our business what goes on there. There might be people who feel that way somewhere, but it doesn't seem like that's going on in our neighborhood.
On the negative side, I've just heard, I mean, I think some people just don't have a clue. And they, you know, they think the worst, but... But the thing I've heard was that the women have picked up was that they think that Abuji is a bunch of lesbians. Of course, you know, there's about 10 kids that have been raised there, you know. So I don't know. But they're all lesbians for us.
It's a fertile place for imagination because because people really, I mean, people don't butt in, so if you don't have any facts, you're not contradicted on anything that you think. So that may be, but I don't think anybody. The people who are actually Obaji's closest neighbors are also our closest neighbors, and they're a God-fearing family. It's kind of almost like a clan, and you know. Maoris.
Yeah.
And I think there was a time when Obaji had problems. They had horses and they didn't have water and stuff like that. And they worked out, you know, they were able to leave their horses over at the neighbors because there was this water available. I don't know, I guess it was funny. The thing was maybe resolved. But anyway, you know, I just don't know. I haven't heard anything from the neighbors that has ever been anything negative about it. It's just they're different people.
Well, we're out of time, essentially. You have any last word of wisdom?
Word of wisdom?
I didn't have a first word.
All right.
Well, I mean, starting honestly, to say something.
No, I can't. I can't think of anything.
I guess my last word is that I had really good experiences. It was a developmental experience, and I thought it was valuable for the rest of my life, which not how much longer that is. I think people should really. I don't think that communal situations are long-term for individuals within it. You know, you're in it for a while and then you're out of it. Sometimes, you know, I want to get a, I want to get a place where I can own my own house and own my own land or whatever, and that doesn't lend itself. But it's I think it's a really good experience for me and hopefully for other people. And it really puts you in close proximity to a diversity of people. And then you can go on with your life after that.
That is. Well, thank you both very much. I think it's been pretty informative.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the question. Okay.
Thank you. I'll see you next week.
Now we can turn on the tape.
Oh, yeah, the tape.